Welcome to the Single Planner Podcast. I've got a very special guest with me today, Megan McGuire. What's up, Megan?
What's up? Thanks for having me today. And actually, this is our Financially Free Friday episode on Fridays.
Yeah, so we're going to do a little show change for folks. I think this will be kind of fun. We just want to have more fun with you guys that are our loyal listeners that have been with us just through thick and thin, through gazillions of student loan pauses, ridiculous court challenges, just exhausting regulatory
mess.
Step one, step two, step eight. Yeah. And so we thought we would dive into what can we do to help student loan borrowers grow wealth. So we thought the best way to do this is to just come out with another episode every week, and then the episode is going to land on Fridays. And the whole idea behind this is to have our Tuesday episode format basically stay the same and be talking a lot about student loan debt kind of stuff. And then if you've graduated, so to speak, if you either just like wealth growth content, or if you've kind of already got your loans forgiven, or you only have, a few payments left to go or something like that, we wanted to create something for you for current in former student loan borrowers to help them grow wealth. And so that's what that episode's going to be, coming out every Friday. Today, we're going to talk about the portfolio that fell out of the coconut tree.
Right.
You are way more in the know about memes than I am. I'm kind of like an ancient elder millennial. I guess you are technically a youthful millennial and not Gen Z. Is that right?
Correct. I feel like I'm like middle of the pack. I was 92. So I can't remember where Gen Z technically starts, but I'm not that much younger than you. I'm definitely on the apps. The apps being like Instagram Reels, because I am a millennial, so I'm not technically on TikTok. It's the Reels that I get all my social information from.
Well, I'm on TikTok, and let me tell you, I'm an amazing dancer. Just watch out. To celebrate today's episode, I've got a coconut lime sparkling water.
Oh,
from
nice.
Wegmans here. So I'm gonna pop that.
I've got a cherry lime poppy. Look at us.
Christine loves that. So the goal of today's episode is we could just talk a little bit about how do politicians invest? And specifically, there was a Wall Street Journal article that came out about Kamala Harris's portfolio. I thought it'd be kind of fun to talk through, is there any lessons to be had for our audience in how she invests along with her husband? And also to talk about maybe some other politicians and how they invest. And the goal is, through our analysis, that it's going to be so amazing and so nonpartisan that you will have no idea if we are part of the Coconut Tree Club or some other club. I don't even know if I said that right, right? I just know the meme is the coconut tree.
Yeah.
If you support Kamala, you have a coconut tree meme by your status on Twitter/X. I never want to call it X. I still think of it as Twitter.
That's weird.
But there are some heavy memes out there, lots of memes. And like I said, forgive me, guys, because I'm not great on the memeology. Megan is sort of our SLP meme ambassador, so hopefully she'll be able to get me back on track if I get off.
Really just means I stay up too late watching memes is all.
Yeah, and I think our PR head, Brittany, said something like she would give me a gift card if I somehow fit into this podcast. Like, this portfolio is in the context of all the portfolios that have gone before or something like that. Kamala has a lot of catchphrases, There's a good number of them, so I'm not going to be great at those, so we'll just dive into the episode. So I'll set the stage, Megan. I just want to get your hot take. The Wall Street Journal portfolio said that Kamala Harris has a portfolio of passive index funds of about $3 to $7 billion in value, and that's her total investable assets. She also has a nice home in the Brentwood area of LA that she owns along with her husband, the second gentleman, and that home has a $2 million mortgage with, wait for it, Wells Fargo, with a 2.6% interest rate, and that the home might be worth like $4 or $5 million or something like that today. What do you think about that type of portfolio, that type of just breakdown of her investments? Like, what are your first reactions when you hear how she's invested?
I love the vanilla boringness of it. That's one. And I feel like she is similar to a lot of the folks that we tend to work with and how we tend to think about financial planning for folks, like definitely getting started building wealth in the sense of like keeping things simple, keeping things like vanilla is okay in financial planning. That's actually a great thing. Like when things are boring in finance, like that's great. And seems like she's done some good work, like building up a portfolio over time passively. And that just means, can you explain like passive investing versus active investing? Because sometimes folks don't know what we mean by passive.
So this article reminded me a little bit of when, there was a post on like Senator Hillary Clinton's portfolio, because it was just like the perfectly optimized portfolio for a politician wanting good returns with just simple, no-nonsense, low costs. And so what we mean by passive investments is just something that tracks the entire economy, like stocks in the entire economy, right? So it's quite likely that she has most of her money in just like a broad, probably U.S. Index fund, but she probably has, I wouldn't be surprised if she has some international diversification too. If you think about what gets a politician in trouble, it's like buying or selling an individual stock and profiting off of that and appearing to have done so from insider information, right?
Yeah.
So if you're wanting to be in politics,
that's because buying a stock is buying into one specific company, and buying like an index fund or even like a mutual fund, you're buying multiple, like hundreds, sometimes thousands of companies. So that's why folks could get in trouble. Like politicians can get in trouble by favoring one specific company, because why do they favor them? There's some, insider information that like, that's a real thing when it comes to stock trading. Like if you know something that the market doesn't know, that is inside information. And Sim and I did an episode recently on, oh my gosh, I'm blanking on her name. The home person. Shoot. What
Martha
the heck?
Stewart. Martha
yes,
Stewart.
There we go. Martha Stewart. Yeah. She got jail time for inside information. She's not a politician, but that was like a really public case about how that's a big no-no.
I just think of her from like the Comedy Central roast, and hers is one of the funniest ever. She started off being like all nice and whatever, and then she's like, prison made me hard as bleep, like I'm this like tough person now. And it's interesting, the feds with her like wanted to kind of like set an example to other people of her stature,
really make an example.
Make an example out of her, right? A lot of people would have just gotten probation or a fine or something like that. They were trying to send a message, don't insider trade. But I wanted to talk about obviously Vice President Harris, because she's the talk of the moment with taking on Trump for the election. But I wanted to talk about a couple other politicians as well. Let's talk maybe a little bit about Speaker Emerita Pelosi. Kamala's total net worth probably somewhere in the $5 to $10 million range, which is definitely a lot of money compared to the average person. But it is quite small compared to a lot of politicians. I think Speaker Pelosi is worth, I want to say it's over $100 million. I'll check real quick. It's a lot. It looks like around $100 million. Well, it depends on who you trust here. Something between like 150 to 250 million,
Yeesh.
Depending on the day.
Double what you thought.
Yeah, a lot of money. Well, it's a lot, right? And so she does have, I think, a lot of individual stocks. And there's the reason I know about that is because there's this kind of, I don't know what you'd call it, but like this kind of sketchy parody Twitter account that's just like invest. I think it's like called like Invest Like Nancy or something. It's supposed to be like a joke account, and it's like, Speaker Pelosi outperforms everything. Mm. Sign up for my newsletter and you can get her trades so you can do these in your own portfolio. What I think it is just like she's an incredibly smart person. She has a very, very large net worth. She probably has some sort of direct indexing strategies implemented, right? Where you're trying to like approximate the market and you're trying to do that for tax reasons to just mitigate the tax hits and get even more tax alpha by doing tax loss harvesting at the individual stock level while replicating like the broad market index too. And stop me if I'm getting too technical, right?
I was just about to ask you, like, could you talk about the breakdown or like the mechanics of direct indexing? Kind of simple terms, like what exactly is that and why would folks with under a certain net worth probably not need to entertain that at this point in their finances?
Yeah. Well, if I talk down to anybody, punch me in the face, but
Yeah, sorry.
I'm just kidding.
I was going to say down to my level. Like, I like simple stuff.
No, I mean, it's good to explain it in a simple way because it's just a better explanation. There's different kinds of like tax loss harvesting, right? There's tax loss harvesting where you're taking, let's just do one fund as an example. You take the S&P 500, when it crashes, you trade it in for the total stock market index, which is almost the same thing, but not quite. And then you wait 30 days and you trade back. So you do that every so often and you build up all these paper losses that when you go and turn around and sell something in the future, you can use all those paper losses to write off a bunch of the gains from something you sell later. So that's tax loss harvesting at a fund level. But the thing is there's variance of the market going up and down, but then there's variance within different sectors and different companies within sectors. Maybe you have a period where social media dramatically underperforms, but the whole market is staying about the same. Well, a direct indexing solution would buy those 500 stocks in the S&P, and then they would sell all those social media stocks when they crash, and then they would buy maybe like a social media ETF that's got most of the stocks in it for 30 days, and they'd swap back into those original stocks after the 30-day waiting period. So in other words, you can capture the tax savings for the broad market, but also at the individual stock level. The thing that gets politicians in trouble that have huge portfolios like Speaker Emerita Pelosi does is, you know, you don't hear about those negative trades. Like, those don't actually ever make it in the news, but the big positive trades do. Statistically speaking, there are bound to be some extremely awkward times when it looks really, really bad. And so I think that's why you don't see more insider trading cases brought, because a lot of this is not insider trading. It's financial professionals that they've hired to manage things for them that are doing the smartest available strategies for somebody with their net worth level. So somebody that's listening to this pod that has like a five-figure or six-figure or a low seven-figure net worth, the reason why we don't recommend direct indexing to them is because you literally have 100 to 500 stocks usually. So that's like a huge amount of individual positions. If you ever want to undo that, it is a bear to undo that. It's super stressful, complicated. You might have to, if you transfer your stuff out to an individual brokerage, you have to go line by line and sell all your positions. And then it's just a lot. So somebody that does direct indexing really needs to be very informed about it, really needs to understand like who is it best for. A perfect example of this would be somebody that's like very charitably inclined, like they donate a bunch of money. And so then you're donating like the biggest winners in your portfolio, and you're constantly doing that to get all the highest gains out of your portfolio. So there are like a lot of great reasons to do it, but you probably wouldn't even do it if you're at Senator, Vice President, I said Senator's a Freudian slip there, Vice President Harris's net worth level. Vice President Harris's net worth level being, you know, 7 to 10 million, a lot of people would implement it around that time, that area. But it is, like they say, where I grew up, is the juice worth the squeeze? Or is the coconut got enough milk to drink, I guess? I don't know. Is that
coconut water? What comes out of a coconut?
Water. Who knows? Yeah. Who knows? But, you know, the whole idea, right, is this is a very smart portfolio. It's a very smart investment strategy for, like, somebody that's running for office. You're not going to get any trouble from it. It's highly tax efficient. It's low cost. You know, the mortgage is really attractive. And, you know, because the person's got low interest debt, there's no need to go out and pay it off, right? If you've got a 2-point-something% debt amount, you don't need to go out and try to pay that down because it's like better than inflation.
One of the things I was kind of bring to light again is the cost effectiveness of her portfolio. Like, she's very cost efficient, it seems like, and tax efficient, which is, I think, what we preach a lot of when we're working with folks. Index funds, very cost efficient compared to mutual funds or other types of investments. And the interest rate game, yeah, you have to kind of play the interest rate game when it comes to deciding, like, do we pay down certain debts over others? Or do we prioritize saving more and investing more over paying down debt? And with an interest rate that low, that's great. She must have, I wonder if she refinanced back in like 2020. I think that's, and you bought like in 2021.
It's an, right? Yeah, it's an adjustable rate. So her rate's an adjustable rate. So I think what that probably signals is if they wanted to pay it down, then they could. But like, if they're going to be able to lock in that rate for an extended period of time, it makes sense to do that. Another thing to be aware of though, is she might not own, maybe doesn't own that many international stocks. She might not have very much of a tilted portfolio. If you're a politician, that might be really smart. So for example, like, you don't want to necessarily have something that is perceived to, as in your role as an official, to like potentially influence how you do things as an official, because it's good for your own personal net worth. So while it might be good for somebody that's not a public official to have like a significant allocation international, maybe have some diversified asset classes that they're exposed to, it might make sense for somebody who's a public official just to say, I'm rich enough, I just want to put it all in U.S. index fund because that's, yeah. You know, and then put it in the entire market and not have any tilts at all, mm-hmm. because that looks the least fishy.
Keeps things very unbiased.
Yeah.
Very clean.
I want to say when Senator Clinton was running, I don't remember the exact amount, but I thought it was a stunningly large amount just in the S&P 500 index. And I think that's the reason, is because, you know, you're trying to avoid any possible appearance of anything if you're a politician. So let's talk about some other folks too. I remember probably from like 2020, or maybe it was 2016, Trump's investment portfolio. So obviously he's known for real estate, but he does have some mutual funds. I think it was very bizarre. Like, it was one, I think it was very small amount of holdings relative to his reported net worth. You know, no comment. In terms of the types of holdings, it was kind of like higher fee funds. It was more active funds, like high expense ratio funds, stuff that you would buy like kind of through a broker. The reason why I think this is interesting is I remember talking to this very high net worth family in the small town where I grew up, and they had four or five different brokers, and they had a bunch of fancy sounding active funds in each one of them. And I was talking to the guy that was managing the family's family office. Well, he was like the family representative to the family office, you know what I mean? And so I was like, well, why do y'all have all these investments in these high fee funds? And he was like, we view it as like a referral potential for our business. So in other words, they had all these businesses that sold things to the community. By having all these different smaller accounts with a bunch of different brokers, they were essentially using that as a referral opportunity, where because they were a client of the broker they were hoping would send them business to their family business to send them customers. So I thought that was kind of interesting. Like, I'd never thought about that before. Like, okay, they're not investing purely for expense ratio. They're like investing essentially for like access and referrals. And because they make a lot more money on referrals these centers of influence make to their family businesses than they save in expense ratios. That's kind of interesting. And so I would assume that that's probably what's going on. Like, why does Trump have all these high expense ratio funds? My guess is there's some sort of political reason or some sort of business reason that maybe whoever's running his family office, or he doesn't care that much about what the fees and the funds are. It's mostly about other reason. In terms of his real estate portfolio, you know, obviously there's this huge disagreement on what that portfolio is worth. There's the value of the assets, and then the Trump Organization always says that the value of the business is more because the value of the brand. Could you kind of explain what is the value of assets that you sell if everything goes under versus something that could be worth, like, how could you value a brand? What does that even mean?
So think about any big brand that you know of, Coca-Cola, or it could be a person too, like Taylor Swift, I feel like is a brand. There's value in a good brand and a good reputation behind a brand. So if you know, there's anything that could risk a reputation or risk the brand itself, that could be really detrimental. But is there something you want to elaborate on there with that one?
Well, I mean, like McDonald's would be another example, right? McDonald's probably has all this real estate around the country. And then if somebody was going to sell McDonald's, like, you wouldn't just pay the price of the real estate. It'd be the price of the real estate plus whatever the value of the McDonald's brand that those restaurants are at is worth. And so the Trump Organization's point of view has always been the real estate is worth X, you know, minus the debt. And then that's a net worth amount. And then what is the Trump brand worth that owns the hotels? So they're always inflating that value, what they think it's worth. Other people would deflate that value and say it's a negative brand value even. Some people would make that argument. And I was discussing this with a friend of mine who is talking about how he was like, you know, Trump's broke. And I was like, well, are you following?
On paper.
I said, well, are you following what's going on with like the whole Truth Social like kind of thing? That's kind of bizarre.
Ooh.
If people haven't
tell us about
it.
That because I don't know if a lot of people, well, maybe some folks have, but I'd love your take on it.
Well, so obviously Trump started Truth Social after getting kicked off Twitter and then stayed with that business once he got allowed to be reinstated when Elon bought X, right, or Twitter. So the thing with this Truth Social is he's got like a huge stake in this right-wing social media company, and depending on the day, like of the stock trading, that stake is worth something like $4 to $6 billion. Just that stake alone.
That's a lot of doll hairs.
Yeah, it's a lot of money. Regardless of what you think of the guy, right? Because obviously there's a lot of opinions about this individual, of course. I think that it's interesting to think about what does all this financial stuff mean? I think it's great to understand all this stuff, even if you think somebody's terrible politically. Just to understand what goes on with all these. Well, yeah, like, I think it's just, mm-hmm. It's really interesting. That's like the value of fame, right? We talk about Vice President Harris having this $5 to $10 million net worth. If she doesn't win, she could go to a very lucrative private sector career and make an absolute massive amount of money and have that drastically go up because she is obviously a top performing individual that became vice president of the United States. If she does win, after the presidency, she'd have any kind of number of opportunities to serve on boards or give speeches and things that presidents tend to do, and make a huge amount of money if she wanted to. And then the Trump kind of thing, he's kind of going after a business strategy where it's just like, get a small segment of the country to absolutely love you. And then you have like a very specific branded asset. If you can take social media, whatever that is, and then take 10 to 20% of that and have it be like a very specific group of people that are on that platform, like that could be a valuable platform. That's basically what's going on. I actually frankly think that's one reason why Musk has kind of taken X in a more like conservative, some would say terrible direction, is because I think that they're trying to like think about Fox News. Fox News entered this media fractured marketplace by being this very conservative, differentiated product. And it seems like, you know, X was trying to do that because I think that they saw what was going on with Truth Social. Even without the following that Twitter has, they were still growing their valuations quite a bit. So I don't know. It's kind of interesting to think about this. I mean, I think that if I was going to say, what are the takeaways from all these people, you know, some of which you might strongly not want to care about what their finances are, I think it's a very reasonable reaction. The takeaways that I would have is like, tax efficient investing is really smart. Vice President Harris is very smart, doing great things with her portfolio. There's a lot there that you'd want to emulate even as a normal average person.
Right.
And then for Speaker Emerita Pelosi, she's kind of showing the value of sophisticated financial planning.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's what people sometimes get fascinated by too, like the sophisticated stuff, the really, I won't say complicated stuff, but just like the more sophisticated investing strategies. People get really fascinated by that and they feel like that should be what they're doing. That may not be the place that you're in, net worth wise, income wise, life wise. It is interesting kind of seeing these political people or people in this space having different strategies, even though they're all in politics.
Yeah.
The same thing with physicians. Like, physicians should all have the same investment strategy, and that's not the case.
Well, even real estate.
Yeah.
Trump is a great example why real estate's not for everybody, because, I mean, he bought into Manhattan back when Manhattan was not Manhattan. If you really think about market timing or being in the right place at the right time, he got incredibly lucky having portfolios purchased in Manhattan back when like the crime rate in New York City was like one of the highest in the country. Like, it was a very dangerous place back when a lot of those higher end properties were purchased. You can't go back and buy assets at like yesterday's values. With real estate, you know, a lot of people might think, well, oh, my buddy that I went to fellowship with has made a ton of money in real estate. Like, they've killed it. Well, maybe that's because people were buying Airbnbs at like 2018 prices with 3% mortgage rates. And so maybe you can't do that today. And the other thing I think that the Trump sort of example shows is obviously he's been bankrupt many different times. You know, a lot of times this stuff doesn't work out. If you take on a lot of leverage in real estate, a lot of times it doesn't work out.
And he has the ability to like stomach it too. Like, so a lot of people don't have the ability to stomach those types of losses, or like financially it would devastate someone else what maybe he's gone through in those cases.
Yeah. And developers are, I mean, you have to be a very extremely aggressive person, I think, to just be a developer. I mean, I see out his locally here. I mean, it's insane. Like, you know, the people that will buy like a huge lot will have to go through like a multi-year process sometimes with like environmental zoning and meeting plans with the city council and putting in all these concessions to the city council. And somebody will be like, I want this extra amenity on here or else I'm not going to approve your zoning request.
All those like permits too. And it's not for the faint at the frugal either.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and then they have the benefit of scale. They have the benefit of building something that it'll be harder to compete with. I'm not saying don't get involved in real estate. I'm just saying get involved in something that you have a competitive edge in. If you want to be involved in side hustles or something unusual or, you know, something interesting where you're not just in boring passive index funds all day, well, then I would say have that boring kind of investment strategy that does a little bit of sophisticated financial planning within it, but then do something that like other people can't just go compete with you with. Open your profession specific practice or partner in a practice, or use a special talent that you have that other people don't have and own the value of that talent instead of having it just be something that you do working for somebody else.
Hey, Is that what you did, Travis, with the student loan planner? Is that what you did? Harnessed your specialty in understanding student loans and created student loan planner?
Well, the other thing is you can harness your talent and then you can be an employee somewhere, but you know, make it something where you have some sort of upside. Make it something where you are either getting an amazing lifestyle. Like, I will say this, some people harness that talent to have the best lifestyle in the world, which I think is a great way to do things too. If you want to have a work from anywhere option, you want to be able to have stability, you don't have to worry about bringing in clients or patients, then maybe it is a great idea to just work somewhere and being an employee. I'm not saying everybody should be a business owner, right? But it's so fascinating to me how many people are on these side hustle and real estate kind of forums online. I read them like for entertainment purposes sometimes, and it's not like people haven't had success. They have, but you don't want to make the mistake that a lot of people do, which is I'm going to do way better than everybody that's ever done this before. Just have a little bit of dose of humility, right? Like somebody was telling us the other day, like all I need is just this one index fund, right? I need one fund and that's all I need. And I said, how familiar are you with the way performance has gone over time for US International, right? Do you remember that meeting? We even had a meeting on this internally. Like, what were your thoughts on just that US versus international graph that I showed you guys?
It's really fascinating where I think everybody has heard be diversified, don't have all your eggs in one basket. And that's the same. Like, we want that same concept when we're talking about US and international. There's a lot of different things on a little investment chart we could talk about having like the opposites of to be diversified. But the chart was really fascinating because the US has done really great lately. We've had a long run of like a good market. But if we look back in the 80s and like what was happening in the US, tax rates were horrible here in the US. But internationally, international funds were doing really well compared to, really well with a little star, but I would say way better than the US. And so someone who is 100% invested in the US would really feel that. Like really feel it. Whereas, you know, someone who was a little more diversified had both international and US in their portfolio, they would have felt it. They would have felt the US hitting, but it would have been more like watching paint dry versus like a yo-yo going up and down, you know?
Yeah. Well, specifically like since 2008, which is most of the time that us, even elder millennials, have been sentient beings paying attention to the stock market. The US has absolutely crushed it. You shouldn't have owned any international at all. You would have wanted to have everything in the United States and that's it. But then If you look at the 2000s, like international crushed it compared to the US. In the 90s, US killed it. Like late 80s, US I think did better, I think. But then, you know, in the 70s, 80s, like international like really dominated at key times, right? And so what happens is it's kind of like the, you know, hey, you should get involved in real estate whispers, meaning that the US has absolutely crushed it. And so you see this proliferation of all this commentary on Facebook groups and stuff like only invest in the US. That's the only thing you need. All you need is one fund. And the problem with that is there is periods of outperformance for US. There's periods of outperformance for international. And you're going to hear from people online, whatever's like most recent that's occurred. And so in the past 15 plus years has been the US has dominated. Everybody's going to say all you need is the US. And I was talking to our team about this. Like, basically, if the US was always going to outperform the international forever, well, then everybody would pour their money only into the United States. And then eventually valuations would get so out of whack that like international would have to outperform. Nobody would invest in international if the US outperforms forever. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of thing where if somebody's thinking about like, you know, examples from politics and how do I apply that to my portfolio, you want to have a balanced portfolio. You want to keep it simple when you can. You want to get professional help if you have anything at all that potentially is considered like complicated, because you'll probably cost yourself more money than you'll save by doing it yourself. I actually had an experience like this that I shared with you recently, Megan. I bought a used canoe.
Oh, yeah. I saw the pictures.
The seats were rotted. Termites ate them. And so I was like, how hard could it be to replace the seats on a canoe? Turns out for somebody that's a student loan expert whose predominant skill set is Excel, it's very hard. It's very, very hard. So I tried to DIY it. It took me 5 hours, but I did replace the seats. But then I found out that one of the bolts was not long enough. And so now I've got to go back and get another screw to with a bolt on it to make it safe. Otherwise, if somebody sits in my canoe in the front seat, they're going to go straight into the boat. So in situations like that, the only time it makes sense to DIY is if you just really enjoy it or you can't find somebody. My concern with the canoe is just, you know, I can't find somebody that off the top of my head that I would know how to fix a canoe. And then, you know, I bought the canoe just because, like, I don't know, I was impatient. I should have been patient. That's another thing. You got to be patient. Like, there was a canoe that was like, I really liked it, but it was only going to arrive in like 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. I was like, it's the summer. Like, I got to hit the water quick, you know?
Yeah.
And then I made that mistake. So
5 hours later. Yeah. That's a labor of love right there. You have to enjoy like the process of doing what you're doing. So do you enjoy like relating that to anything? Do you enjoy the process of researching different funds or allocating your portfolio to get to your goals as successfully as possible? Some people really love that and they thrive off that. They're on Reddit all the time. They're researching things all the time. Great. A lot of folks are not like that though. And that's okay because you're probably way better and way more interested in other things that we need your help for.
That's right. Well, we hope you've enjoyed today's pod. I think we'll probably do another episode at some point on Kamala Harris's views on student loan policy.
Mm, teaser.
Yeah, I know. Get ready. Sequel coming. So if you are interested in fiduciary, student loan aware, profession-specific planning, you can go to slpwealth.com/pod to get the best discounts available anywhere on that specialized level of service. So slpwealth.com/pod. This is the Student Loan Planner Podcast with Travis and Megan. Thank you so much for listening. This podcast is for informational, educational, and entertainment purposes only and should not be considered individualized investment advice. If a specific investment is mentioned, do not consider it a recommendation to buy or sell the investment. Seek first advice from a financial professional before implementing any strategies discussed. All investments involve risk, and past performance does not guarantee future results. Yay, compliance.